are now entering into the story of Pelegish Begivah. This is actually our second section. Last week we considered the relationship between the husband and the Pelegish / Isha, these anonymous couple, and we try to understand it in the context of what we're told in the very small dynamic of the breakup and the reunion. That was what we were told. And now we actually enter into the story. And before going forward, I have to make the disclaimer. This, ladies, is not the most upbeat of part of Tanakh, and this, in fact, is perhaps very sensitive and a very sensitive and destructive era in Tanakh. And so, if there's a rating for this, there's a high age rating for this particular section in Tanakh. But we should consider that Tanakh has included it Ledoros, which means to say that for us sitting here in this room in 2015, 5775. There are things which are resonating with us, which is why we are learning it. It happens to be skipped from most curriculums, but it is important to consider, to learn, and to appreciate in context. So with that, we will actually learn the story itself. So let's just recap for a moment. We have this couple. They seem to break up. The husband seems to go back and wants to reunite with his Pelegish, with his broken relationship. And he does so. He's welcomed in warmly by the father of the girl. And that's kind of where we left it. Let's backtrack to pasuk vav, just to get the sense of what's going on over here. So they come in and they sit down, they eat, and everybody is happy. Now vayeshvu, we just did these pasukim at the very end last time, but let's just recap because there's a flow. Vayeshvu vayochlu shnehem yachtav vayishtu vayomer avi anara el ish hoel na velin v'yitav libecha. So this is the fourth day, and on the fourth day he says, why don't you eat, why don't you drink, let's stay around and enjoy what is going on around here. Fine, fantastic. And he's about to leave. He's, this is day four. It's already a long time with the in-laws, right? So what happens is he's about to leave, and he puts a lot of pressure on him. We noted last time that the word vayiftzar bom is a word which has got a lot of sinister echoes, which comes back to already the Sodom story. We're going to see the parallels are going to resonate louder and louder as we get further into the story. And so the father-in-law is really pressurizing his son. Stay, stay, stay. Wonderful. Vayashkem baboyke vayom ha-chamishi lo leches. So he gets up resolute. When does it? At what time in the morning does he get up?
Early.
We don't know, but we know it's early, right? So The Tanakh is emphasizing that what is on this man's mind is he wants to leave, right? He clearly, this is enough. He's drawn the line now. He's getting up. Vayomer avi ha-na'ara, and again, the father of the Na'ara says, Sa'ad na levavcha, feast to your heart's content. Vayisma ha-mamu'ad ad netoes ha-yom. And just wait a little bit until the end of the day. Vayochlu shnehem, and they both sat and ate. Now, I just want to just all draw attention over here at this point in time. What is the relationship, or what is the description of the young lady at this point in time?
Na'ara.
Right, Tanakh is calling her Na'ara, the father of the Na'ara. Now that's interesting, because there's been another two descriptions that she's had so far. She's had the description of Pelegish and Isha, right, which denote two differing levels of relationship in regard to her husband. Now it's interesting over here we have Na'ara. What is Na'ara in terms of Tanakh terminology? Right, so it's talking about a girl, and generally, by the way, Na'ara is a younger girl who has the father has certain rights over, or decision rights over. So when the Tanakh is telling us Aviya Na'ara, essentially what it's telling us that the way he relates to her is as of a parent who has signing power. Right, when you see those forms and it says, sign here, and if you're a minor, you need parental consent. That's the way he's viewing his daughter, which is why it's interesting that in this whole conversation, there's one voice absent, and that is hers. In this entire interaction, we don't hear anything from her. So just to give the attitude over here, when we want to understand what's going on over here, the father is looking at it from this perspective. He's the one running this relationship, and he's the one making the decisions, which is why she's almost absent from this feasting. Notice something interesting over here. Day five actually differs from all the previous days. What is absent on day five in terms of their stay?
Drinking.
Right. No, did you notice that? There's one word which is absent. Take a look in this pasuk, and that is drinking. They are no longer drinking. The previous days it was vayochlu vayishtu. They were eating and drinking. Suddenly, there's no drinking anymore. Now, at a certain point, right, there must be a capacity. Says the Malbim, if you wouldn't mind just turning to page 6, source 12. Listen to what the Malbim notes. This just gives you an idea of just the precision with which the Mefarshim understands and dissect the text. He notes everything that's going on, and this gives us an insight into what's really going on, not just what's being described. Says the Malbim in source 12, Vayashkimu baboker vayishtu, Ratzeloma bayomer rishon hoya adayin boker. What happened was, in the first few days, what ended up happening is he ate and he drank. And at the end of a drinking party, it's very hard to keep your eye on the road. It was a sign in Rockaway Turnpike, just a few sponsored billboard, is a breath analyzer test. And it said you just blew $10,000 in the breath analyzer test. So what Tanakh is telling us is that on the previous 4 days, he'd been drinking, and it's very hard to drive. It's very hard, even if it's a donkey, to drive afterwards. So what happens? But what happens? He's careful. He gets up early. Why? Because his attitude is, I want to leave. Therefore, he makes sure not to fall into the mistake that he's made in the previous day, so there's no drinking over here. So again, what we're seeing over here is the attitude of what's happening with the husband over here, and the very intense want and will to leave.
Father was asking him actually to wait until later in the day. It makes no sense.
Right.
That's a dangerous time to start.
Okay, so here's an irony. We see over here the father-in-law. What is really behind the father-in-law's attitude over here? What's going on in his mind?
Trying to get him to stay.
He really wants him to stay. They're obviously very dear to him. So therefore, the longer he can keep them, the better. There's a dramatic irony is that his love, or his love without bounds, is actually dangerous. That's what we're seeing over here as the reader, is that he wants the best, but his best might not be the best. That's what seems to be going on over here. We'll see it in just a moment as he carries on. So let's take this further. Let's carry on in the Pesukim. We're now over here in Pasuk Tes. Vayokomo ish oleches, hu pilagsho v'naroi. He gets up, he, his pilagish, and his na'ar. Notice at this point in time, his relationship as towards her is pilagish, meaning the way he's looking at her in terms of relationship is this is not an equal relationship, right? Before she was described as Isha. Now, when he was coming back to find her, now she's a Pilegesh. And the day has become weak, meaning the sun is setting. You know, try tomorrow. Tomorrow is a better time. There's more prospects to leave, you know, when it's nice and early in the day. Right? So again, he's just pleading and pleading. And here's the dramatic irony that Barbara was mentioning beforehand, is the irony is that his deep care for them ultimately results in their danger. That there's a certain line that a person needs to draw, that his care over here is damaging at this point in time. There's an irony in this. And what happens? The son-in-law has really had enough at this point. He says, "In pasuk yud v'lav ish lalun vayokom vayelach." He does not want to stay. He gets up. He leaves Ayavod Noichach Yevus, and he comes to the city of Yevus. He, and what is that city? We know that to be
Yerushalayim.
It happens to be that it's not yet Yerushalayim, meaning it's not yet bought and owned by Jews at this point in time. We know that the Yevusi, which is one of the Jebusites, which are the one tribe or one particular clan that lives in Israel, were very strong, and their strongholds in the mountains of Yehuda were impenetrable for many centuries. And so at this point in time, it's in the hands of the Yevusi. So v'imoy tzemed chamorim chavushim u'pilakshoy imoy, and with him he has this couplet of donkeys, and his pilegesh is with him, and so they're on their way. However, heim im yivus pasuk yudalef, they are just by yivus vayom rad mood, and the day is descending, the light is descending. Vayomer anar el adonav lechonav nasura ilay yivusi azos nolinba. The lad says, "Let's go to the Jebusite city." By the way, it's almost like, you know, sometimes you may appreciate this, is, you know, men don't always get it with directions. You know, that he's not listening, he's driving on. So it takes somebody from the outside to say, you know, I think it might be a good idea. He's obviously so intent about leaving that he needs somebody from the outside to remind him, okay, let's stop at this point in time. And what happens? The suggestion that was tendered is, where should they stay? Is the city, right? They're just passing by this Jebusite city. Vayomer elav adonav, lo nasir lo nasur el ir nachri asher lemimenu lemimnei Yisrael heina va'avarnu ad giva. We're not going to stay in this non-Jewish city. that we couldn't possibly do that. We're going to go on to Giv'ah. Let's just take a look, just appreciate what's going on over here. Take a look at the map at the very back, just to see what's their journey. Yeah, let's see if we can just find this for a moment. Here we are. Okay, so if you see on the very last page, on page 11, this is a map from the Dat Mikra Tanakh, and you'll see towards the middle, in the center, is a along there, there's a vertical line, which is like, almost like a river, which goes through the middle. There's Beis Lechem, that's Bethlehem, that's where they're coming from. Okay, and they're going northwards, they pass Yavus. Do you see where Yavus is? If you follow the line up, that's where they're going, and that's when sunset is hitting. So as you can see, there's not really a nearby settlement at this point in time, but he's still resolute enough that he wants to go a little further, push it further, which is quite a distance to Giv'ah, which is in the territory of Binyamin. You see Binyamin written through there. That's where they're heading at this point in time. Now, there's a penetrating point over here that the Mamlo'ez points out, which is something perhaps that we may hear today as well, and that is that you often hear people who say, you know, the Goyim this, the Goyim that, you know, the non-Jews this, the non-Jews that. And then sometimes those self-same people are the people who you see on the front page of the newspaper in Data just a few years later. And you have to wonder to yourself, you know, at what point are we really distinct in our moral behavior? You know, at what point in time are we living up to the way that we are, the mission that is entrusted to us? And it's a question that's asked. And Tanakh, I think, is asking that question right now. Tanakh is saying, look, here's the man who says, we don't trust, why would we stay in this unsafe, uncouth, vulgar, non-Jewish city? And ultimately the question that Tanakh is raising is Binyamin any better? Is Binyamin any better? Meaning, who's really the moral upstanding nation or city in this story? That's what Tanakh's asking us over here. Very scary question, which over here, clearly Tanakh is giving us, through the satire, is clearly giving us the answer to. By the way, just to recap, just to pull this back to a previous story. In the previous story, there was another non-Jewish city which was mentioned. In the story of Pesel Micha, what happens is you have the tribe of Dan, they see you searching for new territory, and they find this place called Laish / Leshem, right up north. It's a city of Sidon, and what ends up happening is a funny thing, is that the Tanakh tells us that it's a quiet and peaceful and harmonious little village. And the question you have to think of in the story is, here comes in Dan, conquering new territory, not of the territory they should have conquered, because it wasn't part of Israel proper. They went out and found another city and destroyed it, and then adopted idolatry. And you have to ask yourself, so who's the hero? Who's the hero in the story? Right, that's what Tanakh's asking us over here. Nobody in the story is going to be a hero. Unfortunately, there's no good people here. There are no knights in shining armor in the story. And so here's the man saying, he's indicting Yavus, and the question is going to be really, who really is at blame over here? Very, very sharp point that the Mamlo'ez points out in Tanakh over here, which the Tanakh is pointing out to us. Pasuk Yud Gimel, let's take this further. V'yomel ha'naroi, lecha v'nikrova ba'achas melkhamakoma salanu be'givah o baramos. Let's go a little further. We saw on the map, they're just going a little further north. Let's try to find Giv'ah. V'yavru v'yelechus, they carried on, they passed by. And they carry on walking. And they stop when the sun is setting at Giv'ah, which is in the tribe of Binyamin. And they turn off the path. And they sit in the street, which is obviously means to say the main street of the city. And nobody is bringing them into their house to dwell. Just quick Tanakh reference over here. The word ma'asef is a word which appears three times in Tanakh. Wow. Okay, so it appears three times in Tanakh. Two of them are in the story, and the third place is by Shevet Dan. In the Torah tells us that, in fact, there was one tribe which had a unique characteristic, and that was, Dan was called Ma'asef Kol HaMachanos. That Dan was the gatherer, the in-gatherer, and that's for the simple reason that the tribe of Dan traveled last. Whether they traveled in a box formation or in a line formation, which is the Machlokes in the Mefarshim, Dan was always the last tribe. Now, why is that relevant? Let's think about this one. What does it mean? What does it mean that Dan was Ma'asef? He was the gatherer, the in-gatherer. What do they mean? So, on the most basic level, it means to say if you dropped your wallet, the most likely is that the people at the back are going to sweep past it and pick it up. So the lost and found section department in Israel was in Dan. But the Chizkuni takes it one step further. And the Chizkuni says it wasn't just wallets and lost objects, it was about lost people too. Right? People as well. Who are people who are stragglers? Could be weak people, could be also spiritually impure people. Remember, the people who were Mitzrayim were kicked out to the camp, so where were they? They were straggling. They were straggling behind the camp. So Dan was that section in society that was able to sort of incorporate or catch. Now, that is interesting, because why should Dan be relevant to our story at all? I mean, there's only three times in Tanakh that this word appears. This is our hyperlink. Why should it be that two of them appear in Pelegish Begeva in this particular context? We'll see the next one in a few Pesukim, and the third one by Dan. Why? Why would that be relevant? What is Dan? What is Dan done in this particular story or not in the story? Let's reverse one step. Previous story. What was the previous story in Tanakh? Pesel Mecha. Who was the primary actor and move over there?
Lady.
Is there was a microcosm of a person who set up a personal shrine, and what happened then? Then there was a tribe which came in, hijacked the shrine, and adopted it as a national shrine. That tribe was done. So you think to yourself, you know, well, that's a story about Avodah Zarah. That's a story about polytheism. So, you know, we'll leave that on the side. Now we're talking about the moral code and moral behavior of Israel. And Tanakh's saying, not so fast. Remember that perhaps there might be a connection over here. There might be a connection theologically between what happened then and what's about to happen here. Is the moral decrepit state of Israel as it relates to Hashem and as it relates to fellow human being interrelated? That's the question that we're going to have to ask ourselves. Mm-hmm. That this is begging from us right now. Let's take this further. So nobody's bringing them in. That sounds very very much like Saddam, right? We have these two men. They come into the city to visit. Nobody's inviting them in. Wonderful. Well, not so wonderful. But Tez Zayin Vihine. Ish zokein bo min ha-maaseh u min ha-sodeh bo erev o ish mai he-mehar Ephraim v'hu gor be-giva v'anshem ha-kom b'nei yimini. So there's an elderly man, comes from his work in the field in the evening, and he happens to be from Har Ephraim, so he's not a local, and he lives in Giva, and the people of the place are ish yimini. Ish yimini, b'nei yimini refers to?
Benjamin.
That's right. Yimini is the relation, the description of Binyamin. And v'yisa enov v'yare sa ish, he's the only person who greets them. So there's a lot of things to think about over here about this interaction. First of all, notice that Tanakh seems to be emphasizing something about him, and that is
he's not
one of them. Meaning, when the Tanakh says that nobody's inviting them in, that means to say no one of Binyamin is inviting them in. And the only person to notice them is the person who's not a Benjaminite. That's what Tanakh seems to be emphasizing. Where he comes from and the fact that he's just merely Gar. He didn't get citizenship. He's a permanent resident. That's what the Tanakh is telling us. Now, let's take this further. Mamlo A's asked the following questions. How many excuses has Tanakh given us for the reason why he would not want to invite them, would be exempt from inviting in guests? How many excuses does Tanakh give us? First of all, he's not a native. Meaning, I'm not responsible because I'm not part of the town board to be responsible for guests, right? That's up to them. That's them. They're part of the town of, or whichever town it is, Giva in this particular instance. Okay, number one is that he's not resident. Number two is he's a Zakane. Meaning to say, he could very easily say, listen, you know what? I'm a senior citizen. There are other people over here who are young and have big houses who can have people in. They've got servants and they can entertain guests at a whim. But why should I be the one who has to be doing this? Number three, let's take it further.
He's been working all day,
right? Meaning he's not a stay at home person. This is a person who's just it wasn't as if, you know, he'd just walk into the refrigerator and, you know, pull out, you know, the next microwave meal and that's it. Meaning obviously this is gonna take effort. So Tanakh is emphasizing something very clearly, says the Mamlo, and that is that this man has every reason in the world to say thanks but no thanks, but he's the only person who does. That really actually casts more of a shadow on the people of the town. Because he's the only one, and he has every reason in the book not to do that. That's what seems to be going on over here, and that's what Tanakh seems to be emphasizing to us. And he comes over and he says, where are you coming from and where do you go? Interesting nuance in Hebrew language is that, you know, in English, where is a word. You know, it comprises of five letters and it's a functional word. When you go to Hebrew is actually a lot deeper. And that is, what does the word ayin mean, actually? Which is the root of both ayin and ana, which is, ayin means nothingness, right? Ayin means nothingness, efes for ayin. Which means to say that the question embedded in Hebrew, when you ask somebody where you're going or where you're coming from, you're essentially saying you're coming and going to nothingness, meaning to say, it's contextualizing a person in the bigger spectrum. Mm-hmm. Just fascinating point. Ayin and ana come from the word of, you know, the bigger context of humanity as a whole. Just fascinating. This is not a functional language. This is a deeper understanding. Let's take this further. Vayomer elav. So they he says to him, So that's the second time. That's the Ma'asef number two. And he says, you know, we're coming from Bethlehem to go to Har Ephraim, and that's where I come from, and I was going to Beis Lechem Yehuda, to the house of Hashem, and nobody's taking me in. That's what he describes. Now, what is he emphasizing in his introduction? What is he rubbing in right here? What's that? Okay, so here you see something interesting. Where's the man? Where is this permanent resident, this elderly gentleman, come from?
Ephraim.
He also comes from Har Ephraim. So what's the guest saying?
He's
saying we naturally must have some sort of kinship because we come from the same place. You see that he's already emphasizing their natural bond. Very interesting. But then more than that, in terms of his business, where was he going? Where did he say he was going again? He was going to Beis Lechem. Now, why does he have to emphasize that he's going to the house of God, to the Mishkan in Shiloh? Why does he need to mention that he's going to the house of God? Just say he's going to Har Ephraim, the mountains of Ephraim. Why would he need to mention that?
And you only have to defend yourself if there's already an allegation against you. Take a look at the Malbim. Malbim, if I could draw your attention to the booklet on page 6. The Malbim in source. The Malbim in source 13. Perek Yotes Pasuk Yotches. Omar Va'elech Rak Ad Beis Lechem. Why is it that he says I'm going specifically to the city of Beis Lechem? Ulval Yachshov. Why does he need to throw in the extra clarification as to where particularly he's going? Explains the Malbim, because in fact there was another place to go. He could have also been going to Mepesel Micha, because at the very same time, at that self same time, we know that in the mountains of Ephraim was another shrine, not the shrine to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the shrine to Avodah Zarah. And therefore, it's important for this person, and this is perhaps an indication on the sensitivities he understands and the old man he's speaking to, that he needs to justify himself, to rationalize, and to point out that really, in fact, he is attached to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's not attached to Avodah Zarah. Once again, the shadow of Pesel Micha is thrown in the backdrop of this story, and the question we're going to have to ask ourselves is why? What's the connection? Pesel Micha seems to be an issue between humans and God, whereas Pilegesh Begiva, as we're about to explore, is going to seem to be a very big problem, is going to be a concern in society at large, rather than a theological issue. And the question we're going to have to ask ourselves is, what is that real connection? Let's drive onwards in the Psukim. The Psukim carry on, Pasuk Yud Tes. V'gam tevin v'gam ispo yesh lachamoreinu, says the Balabayas, the Ish Levi, the person who's walking through, you know what, we actually have all the food and fodder necessary. V'gam lechem v'yayin yesh li lamosecha, we have any food and wine for ourselves. V'anarim avodecha, ein machsar kol davar. Look, we're going to pay for our own board. We don't need anything from you, we just need a roof over our heads. Wonderful. V'yomer ha'ish ha'zokein sholom lach, Rak macho, kol machos, machsor cho olai, rak bachavarachav altolin. Says the old man very jovially, don't worry, it's fine, you come in, I'll feed you the food, but just don't stay in the streets. You can see already that, you know, even though in his warmness and his willingness to have them, there's something very dark that he can see and he knows about the city that he lives in. And he brings them to his house, and he gave fodder to the donkeys, and they ate and they drank, and everybody's happy, everybody's merry. It sounds very much like Lot inviting in those angels those days ago in Sodom. While they're eating or they're enjoying it to their heart's content, then the men of the city, who are defined as Anshei Bli'al. This could be a subsection of them, or this could be that all the men of the city are Anshei Bli'al. Very good question to think about as to who's perpetrating this. What happens is they surround the house, Nimistabkim Aladeris, and they're knocking on the door, by Yomru Alayish, Bal Habayis, Hazlaken Namar, and the owner of the house, the elderly man, says, they say to the man, bring him out, bring out this man, that we should know him. Know him means literally to know, but in this case it means to say, to sodomize. This obviously brings us back to the case of Lot and the angels, where of course the word sodomize itself comes from the word Sodom. That's where the English etymology of the word actually derives from, because of that original episode, and it's being brought back again over here. Vayetze Alehem, let's just get a sense of the entire section and then come back and think a little bit about this terrible travesty. Vayetze Alehem Oish Balabayas, and the older man walks out, Vayomer Alehem, Alacheu Al Tareu Na, please, my brothers, don't do anything bad. Acharea Sheboha Ish Azel Beisiva Al Taasuez under the Volah Azos, don't do anything bad because he came under the shade of my roof. Hine Bitsia Besulot Pilak Sheu Oisilna Oisam Vinu Oisam Vina Sulohem Gatol Benechem. You know, I have a young daughter, she's not married. They take out this man's pilegish, my daughter, and do whatever you want with them. Please just don't do this terrible thing to this man. They didn't want to listen, and at this point in time it's becoming, you know, clearly increasingly dangerous, as it seems to be, and the man, the Isha Levi, is the one who actually now instigates, it's not the Balabais, it's the Isha Levi takes his Pilegesh, thrusts her outside, Vayosei Aleim Achutz, Vayedu Osta Vayis Anonu Bokol Alala, they abused her all night, Ada Boke Vayishal Chuha, Kalos HaShachar, and they release her at daybreak. Vayetze Vatavo Isha Lifnos Boke Vatipol Beza Isha Asher Adonai Osham Ad Ha'or, and she lies there until night, daybreak. Terrible, really terrible, terrible episode. And what we really need to think about, and what we're going to cover hopefully in the next session, is, are these people around the house, are these people simply animals? Are they people who are completely overcome by lust? They can't control their own natural inclinations, and they're just burning to have some sort of sexual encounter, to have an intimate relationship with whoever they can get their hands on. And they, in a certain sense, we're talking about people who are just lust crazy. Or we talk about people who are ideologically out there to prove a point. Meaning, is the fact that they're looking for sodomy, is that an indication of their lust, or is that an indication of their want to demasculate, to prove a point, to really make another person almost powerless? What's really guiding them? How bad are they? Is the question we need to understand. We're going to discuss this a little bit in terms of the Mepharshim, in context of the Mepharshim, we're trying to understand this in parallel to Sodom itself. And really, the whole thing, unfortunately, you're going to see over here is that there are no heroes. You know, the person who perhaps was the person who had held the most hope and stock in was the older man, who's the man who goes against the grain of society. He invites in guests when guests were not welcome. And you think, you know, he's the man who's going to represent the moral standard. And in the end of the day, what do you see? You see that he himself is the one who offers his own daughter and the Pilegesh in order to prevent this whole instance. Very, very, very difficult to understand. This entire incident from beginning to end is difficult to understand. We're not going to be able to understand any answers which will fully satiate and at least appease the terrible questions that are burning within us. But just to appreciate one or two perhaps factors which make this this case a little more tenable. Let's take a look for a moment at and the Radak. The Radak is to be found, this is the Radak on this episode over here, he's to be found on page 6, this is in source 14, Yutes Chodbeis. The Radak says the following. He says, V'yesh Lomar, it is possible to say, Ki hayu roitzim lehorgoi k'moy shesiper hu, oy si dimu laharoig. We're going to see later on, in the next parak, when he recounts his story, when he retells his story to the rest of Bnei Israel, he says the following, they wanted to kill me. Now, it's interesting, and at this point in the story, do we see this? We don't. We don't see any seeming indications about death at this point in time, or threats. And says the Radak, so therefore, what is the old man saying? Don't do this Nevala. He's not talking about, necessarily, the sodomy. He's talking about the Nevala. Don't kill this man. That's what he's saying. Okay, so he talks about how the Mepharshim deal with the word Nevala and understanding that in relationship to death and sodomy. What seems to be very clear from the Radak is the following. is that you have to merge the way he saw the story as to the way the story was happening. Without assuming that he's lying and he's just embellishing, what it seems to be clear is that from his perspective, when he's in this house, which is being surrounded by thugs, you know, the crowd of the pitchforks and tar, and they're making a noise and they're bashing the doors and the windows, what is very clear in his mind is that when he's going to be thrown out there into that crowd, it's not going to simply be a pleasure pleasure party for the town folk. They're going to be killing him. That's what is going on in his mind. So what he does is, under those circumstances, incorrectly, what he does is he tries to defend himself with whatever he has. And he throws out his pelegesh. Why? Because he was so terrified of what was going on. Now, in these circumstances, is that justified? Absolutely not. Happens to be that if you read a lot of literature on this particular incident, you'll see some of the academic literature will indicate that, you know what, in those days, in the hierarchy of the family, that was what was accepted, is that there was a different tiers of who's more important. And of course, the men in that society were more important than the women or the children. And so therefore, it was a natural thing for him to throw out his wife. I'd like to just point out that although it sounds like something tenable, and although it's something which many of us perhaps are thinking in the back of our heads, I'd like to point out that this couldn't be further from the truth. Take a look for a moment at the next source. This is the Midrash Tanchuma in source 15. It's in Vayera Yud Beis, and the reason why it's in Vayera is because that is where the episode of Sodom actually occurs in its full and terrible glory. The Midrash says the following: B'noheg Shva Olam, the way of the world. He's not saying the way of Jews. He's saying the way of the world, meaning natural, the natural instinct in humanity. Adam moiser atzmoi lehareg al b'noisov v'al ishto v'horeg o'nerag. A person will do everything possible to defend his own family. A person will put himself in front of that train in order to stop his wife or children being hurt. V'zeh moiser al b'noisov l'yisoel albam. And this person, meaning Lot, is throwing out his daughters. Omar le'akodesh baruch u'chayecho la'atzmocho atam shamron. You think that they're your property? You think that you have the right to throw them out, they're going to come back to you, and you're going to father children from them. That's what the Midrash says. What do you see over here? The basic underlying assumption in this Midrash, which is reflecting on the times of this biblical era, is that Adam Moser Atzmoy Al Ba'am Yishtol V'Abunayisot, that a person is expected, a person is naturally, the natural human instinct is to defend one's family. So whether or not he felt threatened or not, it's important to put this Midrash over here and to think about this very carefully. Was he doing the right thing? He was not doing the right thing. With no mitigation, with no excuses, this man was not doing the correct thing. Why was he doing what he was doing? It seems that at this point in time, he is extremely scared. He is terrified of what's going to happen. And in his weakness, he throws somebody else onto the train tracks. That's what it sounds like is going on over here. An extremely sad twist of fate over here. and both the man, the Balabayas, and the Isha Levi are not people of glory at this moment in time. And that's perhaps why in Pasuk Chavav, which we just read, where it says that she returns to the threshold and the place where Adoneho Sham, Adhoor, Tanakh is emphasizing something. We've seen different levels or different ways of describing the relationship of this lady to that man. We saw at the beginning it was Isha, when he comes to bring her back. Then Pilegesh, which is one stage low in the relationship. And now she's called in relationship to him. She says where her master is there. Why her master? Because Tanakh is emphasizing something very important. And that is that the way he has treated her is as property. And therefore the way that Tanakh relates her to him again is Asher Adonai Hashem, where her master is. He treated her like any part of his property. He threw out his coat, rather than getting hurt himself. That's the way he treated her, not like a human being, but as a piece of property. And Tanakh emphasizes this. Now what's perhaps even worse in this entire story, and the story only gets worse, the story really doesn't heal itself, unfortunately. And what's worse perhaps is now what happens in the morning. And we meet him back in Pasuk Chof Zayin. Vayokom Adoneho, and her master, once again, her master gets up in the morning. Vayiftat al sos abayis v'yezel likra leleches adarkon. And he's walking out, he's going on his way. V'hinei ha'isha pilagshoi noferes pesach abayis v'yodeh al asaf. And there, on the doorstep, with her hand on the threshold, is his pilegesh. Vayomer aleha kumi v'nelecha v'ein oneh. He says, no, let's go. No answer. And he picks it up and he goes off into his place. Now, what's terrifying, what's perhaps so chilling about these psukim is it sounds like, Habdil, you know what it sounds like? It sounds like he had a good night's sleep. You know, he slept in the queen bed all by himself. Gets up in the morning, pours himself a bowl of cornflakes and orange juices, reading the New York Times, and then happens to be taking a stroll outside and bumps into her. Any normal human being, any person who'd been in such a situation, would they have gotten a wink of sleep that night? They'd have been by the window peering out to see. Perhaps he could save her. Perhaps there's a moment where they run away and he could take her back in. And that's not what's happening over here. There's something missing. There's something missing in the relationship that he has with this woman. There's something missing in his psyche. He seems to be the person at the beginning is going back to bring her back and to reunite the relationship. And we're all thinking, what a wonderful person. And you know, look, he's trying to make it up. But in the end of the day, look what's happening over here. Where is that hero? Where did he disappear? Terrible, terrible silence over here. He speaks to her as if everything should be all right. And ain't on there, there's no answer. Gets worse. He takes her back to his house. And he takes her and he puts her down and he cleaves her. He cuts her into 12 different pieces and sends them to the different tribes of Israel. One has to really, really think carefully about what's going on over here. Thing number one to consider. Let's just conclude this section and then think about things. Let's read the last pasuk over here. Lamed. Anybody would see this. We've never seen anything like this. You know, you've never seen anything this horrific, this terrible, this graphic. Speak about what you think. That's what he says with the note that he sends out with these body parts he sends out. Now, there are lots of things to think about. First of all, just an interesting point is that one of my teachers, Rav Chaim Angel, points out that, you know, unfortunately, there is something which is actually omitted in this psukim. What have we not seen the psukim say up till now? What have the psukim not told us about her? It is interesting that the psukim never told us that she died. The psukim never said that she in fact died. She says she arrives at the door frame and she's lying there. There's an ominous background, and the question is how did she die? Did she die that night? Or did she die when she was cleaved to parts? Not clear. We don't know that. Most of the Mefarshim assume that she's already dead before this has happened. But at the same time, one has to really question this person as well on those grounds. Moreover, let's take a look at the map again at the very end on page 11. Let's take a look at what's going on over here. If you look at the map and you'll see in the middle, towards the bottom, there's the line which says Beis Lechem, a little dot. That's where they're coming from. Remember, they were moving upwards, northwards, along that center line. Northwards, they passed Yavus, that's where they didn't stay. They went to Giva. That's where they are now. Right, so that's a relatively short distance. We're talking about using the legend. We're talking about probably about six or 8 kilometers. Okay? Now, where are they heading? They really are heading to Yarkasei Har Ephraim. That's where he lives. You know, around Shiloh. If you take a look at the map, that's much, much, much further north. Right? Definitely double the amount it would take to go back to her father's house. Isn't that interesting? His first reaction is not to take her back to her father's house and perhaps try to resuscitate her, try to explain what happened to her father. He moves away from that. Isn't that interesting? Her father doesn't seem to feature in the rest of the story. He's moved away from that. Whether this is because he can't face her father, whether this is because he feels guilty, we don't know. But the point is he's no longer going back, even though the father is closer in the south. Now we have to think about what's going on over here. What we're seeing is something interesting. Is the person who in the night was a person who was at the very best a person who was not courageous, a person who's not willing to protect his family, a person who flees in the face of the crowd, at the very best, that's the best we can describe him. This person now suddenly becomes the knight in shining armor. Suddenly he becomes, or he's trying to profess to the public, that he is the man of morality. He's the man who's going to set the reason of society. And he sends out this to shake up the rest of Israel, because he's going to, from now on and inwards, demand the moral responsibility of society. Which is fascinating, because we as the reader know, which everybody else it doesn't. And that is that we know. We know what really happened that night. No one else does. No one else does who's receiving these body parts. No one else is called to this moral war where they were going to see. Actually knows what really happened that night. And that's part of the terrible, terrible situation over here. Why is he cut up in 12 parts? Well, why 12? So the Mefarshim explained that it's really referring to the 12 Shvatim. Does he send to Binyamin? That's the question the Mefarshim deal with. Mamlo Eis talks about that perhaps Binyamin, in fact, was excluded. And we're talking about Menashe and Ephraim were given and Levi. And so therefore, Binyamin is actually excluded from this, which is already interesting because when he's trying to rectify the situation, he excludes one tribe, according to this, which therefore is perhaps a flawed way of dealing with this. We're going to see as the tensions of Binyamin rise. Let's also consider the following. The Malbim says something very fascinating. Why was he cutting up into pieces? Meaning, besides the shock effect, which is clearly and most graphically understood over here, but says the Malbim, this is again on source 16, page 6, Yud Tes Chav Tes, says the Malbim, V'yaschir al atzamer l'shneim asach nesachim, Hera lohem boze ki shifte ka misachtim kaguf echad. He says, you know what? We're supposed to be one body with different parts. U'komo shelo yitzuyar yachul ruach ha-chayim v'asechel ha-begviya im ha-noitzeach l'nosachir ki ozay vorem pilgarim eisim. If you chop it up, it's no longer a body. It's no longer one composite enterprise. Kain lo yitzuyar yachul ma'achayim v'ashchino al kal ha'uma. Im chalakei yisparzu v'shifteo lo yisachtu kasher yisachtu kol ha'ivorim l'ha'amodas ha'achay b'chlal. And therefore he says, the Shechina is not going to come. The life of Israel is not going to descend when they're in separate and disparate parts. And what was his message? His message was perhaps the underlying, and this is something which seems very positive, is the underlying Achilles heel of all of Sefer Shoftim. All of Sefer Shoftim suffered from disunity. All of Sefer Shoftim suffered from tribal mentality, where one tribe would take over and perhaps bring salvation to that particular area. But there wasn't a sense of continuity. There wasn't a sense of cohesion. And his question that he poses to all the people of Israel is, are we like a split body? Are we not going to be able to have a federal government which is going to set the standards of morality? That there's going to be certain lines which cannot be crossed like which happened the night before. That's the question that he's posing to society. Again, to us, it's a dramatic irony, because at the end of the day, we know his role in the whole situation. What is interesting over here is a number of things. And that is, first, is that the shock that they're going to get is not because of the rape. The shock they're going to get is actually because of the dissection. Interestingly enough, that's what's fascinating. That's number one. But he's using that shock effect to play into the rape, which is interesting. That's what Barbanel points out. But what is so interesting to me is that, you know, was he? Do we condone him for such an action? Without, let's divorce for a moment his role in the whole episode the night before and whether he felt justified or not doing what he was doing. Is he allowed to do such a thing? Is this, you know, we know that in Judaism there's such a high expectation on Nivul Hames. What's going on over here? So fascinatingly enough, somebody actually showed me a beautiful, beautiful response of the Chashukei Chemed of Rav Zilberstein. He says the most interesting thing. This is that he has these very, very unusual shilas which come to him all the time. And the shila that he was approached with was the following. He was told that there was a shul which Rachmana Litzlan was violated. There were vandals who came in and broke into the shul overnight and vandalized the place. And they walk in the mornings and Rachmana Litzlan, there on the floor is lying the Sefer Torah. And the question that they had was, you know, everybody immediately rushed to pick up the Sefer Torah and restore it to the Aron. But one of the Gabbaim said, leave it on the floor. Leave it on the floor until the police come, so they can see, first of all, the full magnitude of the desecration. Number two, that they should get real fingerprints and be able to perhaps make one step of advance in terms of apprehending these looters, these raiders. And the question is, can you do that? Are you allowed to leave the Sefer Torah on the floor for this value? That's the question that was posed. He says, of course one is allowed to. There's a hasif in Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch Paskin, very fascinating halacha, that if a person is traveling in an area which is dangerous and one is carrying a Sefer Torah and one is concerned that there are people who perhaps will violate it, what is one is allowed to do is one is actually able to put it into the saddlebag and ride on top of it. That means to say you're sitting on top of the Sefer Torah. How could you sit on top of the Sefer Torah? In order to preserve its own dignity. In other words, a minor indignity is sufficient to justify saving it from a greater indignity. That's the halacha Shulchan Aruch, and he says in that case, that's active, you're actually actively putting it in your saddlebag and actively riding on it. Over here, it's inactively letting it remain on the floor. So no question. And then he references an Igros Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein, which actually appears in the source books, but we're not going to read it inside at this point in time. The Rav Moshe says the following, this is to be found in Yeradeh, Chelek Beis, Simon Kufnun, and very, very sensitive tshuva. He's talking about a particular time in which in Eretz Yisrael there was mandated autopsies in a particular health institution, and his response to some of the shayas which came up. And in the fourth section of his tshuva, he asks, Imutu l'havia evorim l'hafkana. Can one take all the bodies which have been desecrated, but the bodies which have been chopped up for science? And this is, by the way, is a greater topic. I just spoke recently about this, the notion of autopsies in halacha, much bigger subject than we have the time to deal with now. But be it as it may, the question is that it seems that to be that it was done across the board, not only on a case by need basis, that it was done across the board. And the question was, could they take the body parts and display them at a hafgana, at a protest, in order to riot, to raise crowd revulsion as to what's going on, in order to be able to protest against the circumstance. Rav Moshe Feinstein says in the most unbelievable, penetrating insight, he says that it would be permissible where? From Shoftim Perek Yud Tes. He says, because what you see happens. The man is trying very, very hard to create a indelible mark. He's trying to create such a shock in order to prevent further instances, in order to prevent further gang rapes. What does he do? He chops her up in order to be able to show them, to be able to create such a revulsion. Is it allowed, says Rav Moshe? You see that if, and he puts this as a big if this man is well intended, and this time, at this point in time, it seems like he is, even though his actions beforehand weren't. If this person is well intended, then in fact, yes. And it seems to be very clear from the Gemara that the man was not an evil person. Not for now, we'll get into it a little bit later, hopefully. It seems to be that this person was well-intended, and for the sake of well-intention, perhaps even this, one is able to desecrate the body in order to be able to preserve many bodies in the future. That's what Rav Moshe says. We're from our very own situation, as we get it from the Pelagish Begiver. What lies in front of us is to try to understand this in the context of what was going on in the minds, or perhaps in the bodies of these people surrounding the house. How similar and how dissimilar is this to Sodom, and therefore how much of a question on society this really is. How much of a question is this on the society at the end of Sefer Shoftim? I thank you and look forward to learning next week.